Hi, this is Ted Nelson. I'm recording this late at night on the 28th or morning of the 29th of May, 2011. Trying not to disturb anyone else in the house and trying not to bother the recording with the mouse click so that I scroll down the screen. I thought of rewriting this, but I think I'll just read it as published on the 22nd and 23rd November 2007, the 50th anniversary of Anything and Everything. The First Rock Musical Remembered, Part 1, The Initial Ideas. Oxford, 22 and 23 November 2007. To the best of my knowledge, the first rock musical was performed 50 years ago today. No, you probably haven't heard of it. It ran as scheduled for two nights at Swarthmore College near Philadelphia. I wrote and directed it in my junior year when I was 20. There is even an LP. Was it technically a rock musical? Well, it had rock songs, at least nine, others borderline. A plot with persistent characters, thus not just a rock concert. More than one act, thus just not just a revue or musicale. Well-known early rock musicals include Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar, but these came much later. Bye Bye Birdie, which played on Broadway in 1960, appears to have come the closest, but Anything and Everything played in 1957, and I think that makes it number one in history. How it happened? For a decade, Swarthmore students put on an annual, quote, Hamburg show, unquote, a term presumably intended to sound messy. In the 50s, it was officially sponsored by the Association of Swarthmore Student Athletic Managers, no one knew why, which was called QWINK, capital W-I-N-K, no one knew why. Playwrights were thin on the ground at Swarthmore that year. Grandin Conover, our best playwright, was apparently not interested. My play, Getting Colder, had won the one-act contest earlier in the year, so I guess that put me next in line. The QWINK guy said I could write the 57 Hamburg show if I collaborated with a fellow student named Tex Windham. I liked Windham, who conducted really excellent Dixieland jazz, but the briefest of conversations showed me we could not work together. I was a cynical New Yorker, and he was not, having a much more mainland perspective. That alone settled the matter, never mind the deep problems of any collaboration. I suggested that he write one act and I another. He declined and left in a huff. That left me holding the whole franchise. Wow! A whole musical to myself, and I've only got 2 months. Now what? The initial ideas and how they grew. I had only a few ideas at the start. Foremost, I wanted to write the first rock and roll musical. Rock and roll at the time meant Buddy Holly, the Coasters, and anything with an electric guitar. This was long before the Beatles and just after Elvis' Ed Sullivan appearance, which had little impact. Nobody called it rock at the time, though it had been around for perhaps 5 years and had become a serious market. Oh, Nelson, rock and roll won't last, everyone said. I replied that it would last a long time, and was I right? How I would get the rock and roll music written was another matter. As a cynical New Yorker, I was much taken by the songs of Brecht and Weill from the Threepenny Opera, which was playing at the West Village, in the West Village, and strongly appealed to my bohemian angers. I wanted these same rough harmonics for the bitterness I intended to express. However, combining rock and roll and Brecht and Weill could be a problem. By luck. I don't remember how, I found a freshman named Dick Kaplan who declared himself willing to write the music as I wanted it, with the rocking arrangements and threepenny sound. He did a wonderful job, exactly what I asked for, even though he had to do all this composing on the upright piano in the front parlor at Parish Hall. Passers-by kept saying, "It sounds like Threepenny Opera." I couldn't have been more pleased. I wanted to print the program as a big poster. I think this was a new idea at the time. Initially, I wanted it to be on butcher's paper. I had one idea for a great scene. The college at that time owned a three-story aluminum scaffold that snapped together with spring latches. I thought it would be a great effect for a chorus to come on stage carrying the parts of the scaffold, singing a bitter song as they snapped it together and climbed it. However, Cliff Renshaw, who managed the Clothier Theater, among many of the facilities, would not allow the scaffold's use. So the bitter song in the chorus stayed, but without the powerful scaffold business. The start of college in September gave only 8 weeks till curtain time. I already had a pile of one-liners saved up, but no strong plot particulars in mind and could use some more jokes, so I invited people to join me in a brainstorming session, I think in a room called Parish 21, generally used for freshman English. Perhaps a dozen people came, supplying some funny lines and a bunch of ideas. I took these away and juggled them in the solitary processes of inspiration. Gradually, a vision began to emerge. I would present the boredom, loneliness, and enmities of Swarthmore in a cynical but playful way, also the mad sexual tension of the place. These were the 50s, when sex did not officially exist, condoms were, quote, for the prevention of disease only, unquote, and no one was allowed in the dorm of the opposite gender. So much was different, but we did what kids always have done, except more sneakily than today. I put together two acts showing the school in its different aspects, the optimism of freshman week, the boredom and desperation of seminars and romances, the mutual antagonism of fraternity and non-fraternity guys, the pomposity of the administration. In the show, this all took place at Rathsome College, a name which expressed everybody's anger and was also a nice anagram. Not for Swarthmore itself, but for Swarthmore, the common mispronunciation among those less academically aware. The title. The show's title had a rich history. As a freshman and sophomore, I had published a little magazine, very little, palm-sized, called Nothing, officially from the Swarthmore Dada Club. Then Charlie Harris published a detailed parody of it called Something. In his annual commencement address, President Courtney Smith, with whom we students had a love-hate relationship, recounted these two student magazine titles and said, "Next we may expect to see anything and everything." So that had to be the name of the show. The program poster. The program, which indeed became a large poster, was perhaps the best part of the show. Russ Ryan, Swarthmore's great cynical cartoonist that did the overall artwork, then into this I dabbed photographs of the cast members. It was on white paper. The printer said butcher's paper was infeasible. I'm going to read you some URLs now. There's an overview of the poster at hyperland.com/A&E(program-SML.png). Close-ups at, same directory, /A&E(program-SML.png). And then similarly, hyperland.com/A&E(program-SML.png). The first Rock Mug musical remembered, part two. The songs. The Lion and Kangaroo. There turned up an old Swarthmore songbook from the 1920s or earlier. It had a dopey song. "Oh, we're going to the Hamburg show, see the lion and the wild kangaroo, and we'll all stick together through rain or shiny weather, because we're going to see the whole thing through." This was so wonderfully inane that for old time's sake I began the show with it, and with a lion and kangaroo character played by Kaplan and myself. Russ Ryan designed masks for us and brilliantly thought of having the kangaroo wear lederhosen, leather shorts whose front flap looked like a kangaroo pouch. Apparently this dopey song was generic in U.S. culture of the early 20th century. I've since run into it with the opening line, "Oh, we're going to the animal show," which probably came first. To my great chagrin, people thought I wrote the damn thing. Including it in the show was intended merely as nonsense nostalgia. Certifiable rock numbers. Here were some of the rock numbers. The opening number, The Rock and Hamburg, the old-time Lion Kangaroo song rearranged. A phony dance craze number. Since who knows when America's had songs pretending to celebrate some non-existent dance craze that the songwriters hope will catch on. Such fictitious dances have included the Varsity Drag, the Hucklebuck, the Tighten Up, and hundreds more. In our show, our obligatory fictitious dance craze was the Rockadoodle. You can hear Do the Rockadoodle. Oh, it's on this record. The vocalists wish to remain anonymous. Another very rockular number, perhaps inspired by Aldous Huxley, was Orgy Porgy. Vocalists Lynn Milgram and Brian Mangrum. The best songs. Two of our best songs, perhaps borderline rock, were directly inspired by Threepenny Opera numbers. The bitter chorus, Song of Significance, inspired by Those Among You Full of Highest Teaching, and That Office, which was inspired, I just realized, by Pirate Jenny. Hear it sung by me. The other best song was inspired by a friend of mine who dropped out of Swarthmore. It's Not Bad Being Out of College, to be heard sung by Dick Kaplan. Some of the lyrics were in what might be called Sondheim style. One was an anti-fraternity song. Swarthmore had at the time 5 fraternities of the milder sort. This show was from the other faction of the campus. The frat heads, as we called them, would make fun of our long hair and non-Ohio clothing, so this song was a reply. After the protagonist is ridiculed by fraternity guys, he sings, Some people have no earthly reason for metabolism, except to jape and jeer at all the rest. Warmed within the confines of their confidential cabalism, infant fledglings chirping from the nest. Liberty, equality, conformity. Liberty, equality, conformity. Here for eternity, in your snug fraternity, safe from life's enormity. And there's other verses, and then it ends. I cannot help but pity those poor sentimental ritualists, their reverence for trivial amenities. They claim that in their secret thoughts they're really individualists, the foolish hypocritical obscenities. Liberty, equality, conformity. Liberty, equality, conformity. Here for eternity, in your smug fraternity, safe from life's enormity. Bypassing the censor. These were days when censorship was strong, because sex was forbidden and they didn't want us to think about it. Ha! The guys from Quink were warned that they had to censor my script with a strong eye, especially watching for sexual innuendi. I was not allowed to add any material without their seeing. They didn't say I couldn't subtract. I checked that with them. So the obvious trick worked beautifully. After getting approval for the script in one form, I deleted one page, which I had written intentionally to be deleted. This changed the entire meaning of the dialogue, making it very naughty for the time. I think the amended version went as follows. The guy and girl sitting in the snack bar, a friend approaches. Friend, did you get your paper in? Guy, not yet. Friend, will you have it in tomorrow? Guy, maybe sooner than that. Strong stuff for 1957. Shifting my chair. The first rock musical remembered, part 3, Have You Seen? The most daring moment, however, was a song implicitly criticizing the villainous college dean, in reality Dean William C.H. Prentiss, widely believed by students to be a son of a bitch. In the song, I dared almost to call him that. The song was in the form of a barbershop quartet whose chorus went, Have you seen? Have you seen? Have you seen what the dean has done? Oh, life could be rich without ever a hitch if the dean weren't a son of a gun. Now, in order to get this past the censors and not tip our hand, we had to rehearse the quartet in the parish parlor. So I substituted instead the following asinine lyrics with the same rhyme scheme. Have you heard? Have you heard? Have you heard the word from the bird? He had no excuse, for the duck was a goose, and the bird is a terrible nerd. This garbage confused bystanders and may have caused some people to stay away from the show. However, the ruse worked nicely, except that on the record, one of the singers accidentally breaks into the mock lyrics instead. Those parallel lyrics are of some etymological interest also because the term nerd, new at the time, meant then a socially incompetent person. The Frisbee number. The most successful number was about a new fad. Just the spring before, 1956, Frisbee had come on the scene. The show was performed before Wham-O got the trademark, so we spelled it differently then, but never mind. For the song Frisbee with the Frisbee, we turned up the house lights and threw Frisbees over the audience with fair accuracy. That is to say, no one was hurt, or at least no one complained afterward. I think there were six of us throwing, Lion, Kangaroo, and whoever else in the cast had a good wrist, with maybe four discs in action at once. Betty Ladd sang the number from the stage while the audience looked all around in wonderment and ducked. Even here was a chance for naughty innuendo. The last chorus went, Frizz me the Frisbee, then you can kiss me, give it thrust, you must, you must. Again, this was raw stuff in those days. The Fish Bicycle Line. A prominent line in the show was, a man without faith is like a fish without a bicycle. That wisecrack has a convoluted history tracked by my good friend Charlie Harris. It goes like this. The line was coined by Charlie Harris and Bob Cotton. One of them, my guess is Bob, remarked, a man without faith is like, and the other, my guess is Charlie, finished, a fish without a bicycle. They offered that line in the brainstorming session, so it went into the pile of pieces I was putting together, then into the script and onto the stage. By and by, the line reached the great anthropologist Gregory Bateson, who quoted it somewhere. I believe Bateson may have gotten the line from me when we were office mates in Miami in 1962 or 1963. Then the line found its way to Gloria Steinem, who changed it to, a woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle. And that is the form in which the saying lives now. The Fight with Baltimore. There were several stage managers. The main stage manager didn't do much, but in charge of lighting was a guy named David Baltimore, who was extraordinarily efficient. He had acquired a radio headset, which I'd never seen before outside a TV studio, for communicating with the others. He took over more and more duties, thus becoming, in effect, the main stage manager by the night of the first show. The night of the second show, an hour before curtain, Baltimore confronted Kaplan and me. Now I think I know what this show is about, he said, and we're going to make the following changes. I listened and then said, then you can do the show without us. Come on, Dick, let's take a walk. And we took a leisurely 10-minute walk around Parish Hall. When we returned, Baltimore gave in saying we'd do it the old way, but pick up the pace. In fact, Baltimore's suggested changes were good, but it was late in the game and his presentation was all wrong. Confronting us in that way guaranteed the fight. The first rock musical remembered, part 4, The Aftermath. Audience reaction. The audience reaction was, shall we say, muted. A group of fraternity guys left the auditorium in the middle of liberty, equality, conformity. However, several people later said polite things to me about specific parts of the show. I got away with it. Most important, there was no retaliation from Dean Prentice. This, I later learned, was partly because the faculty loved the show. They liked it more than the students did, I think because it represented the kind of initiative and mischief they wished they themselves could express. The review. In reviewing the show, the college paper, The Phoenix, was very kind. It said nice things about me and called the show sluggish, which was a very polite description of the show's pace. One attendee was quoted as saying, after the second act, I wished it would go on forever, and then it did. The record, C-label at hyperland.com/AAMPTZ1A.png. We cut a long playing record for which I made up one of the first silly record company labels, Truly Zorch. The recording session was a week before the show, in order for the record to be sold at the intermission. Bob Guy, an entrepreneur in the record business at that time, quoted a flat fee of $800 for the whole project. He came down and taped all 20 numbers, maybe more, in a marathon session, maybe 16 hours, then delivered the records in cartons the day of the show. Alas, the performances on the record suffered from insufficient rehearsal, as did the show itself, but worse. The record did not sell well. A friend, Michael Curlin, said he would try to place it at record shops, but I'm not sure he did anything. Nor is it clear that they would have wanted it if he had. However, over 50 years, I've disposed of nearly all the records in one way or another. Currently, I can lay my hands on just two. Errors of judgment. In this show, I made two great errors of judgment. First error, giving into pressure. When I described the first two acts, people would say, "You have to have a plot." I gave in and added a plot. A third act with a silly story about a student who happens to be a young Middle Eastern potentate and various spies messing with him. At the denouement, the Russian spies capitulate to some deal, delivering their answer by painting it on the water tower, a perennial Swarthmore prank. Third act was a huge mistake. Second error, size in general. The whole thing got too big. There were too many songs, 20 are on the LP, and I think there were even more in the performance. There were too many participants, around 75, possibly outnumbering the audience. After the big bitter number ending act two came a prophetic lyric. "You thought this was the finale? Well, you're wrong. It's just another loud and crowded song. And perhaps the trouble is you want your towels marked, hers and his. Or it may be that the play is just too long." But I learned the lesson. I did two more rockish musicals at musicales that's working on, called respectively Something for Nothing and Umpthing, and kept them small. See program for Umpthing with cartoon by Kathy Johnson at hyperland.com/UMPTHIMV/PROGRAM.JPG. This meant they could be done quickly, perhaps 1 month and 1 week respectively, and to everyone's much greater satisfaction. Alas, neither was recorded. The lesson transposed. The following year, when I did my student film, The Epiphany of Slocum Furlough, I kept the plot minimal and concentrated on atmosphere and character. Some love it, some don't. And after I got into software in 1960, I always insisted on minimalist, clean design. Where has everyone gone? Everybody and anything and everything worked hard to fulfill its vision. I thank them then, and I thank them now. I don't know what happened to most of them. I've only run into a few. I hope all have done well. I last saw Kaplan in the 60s when he visited me in Poughkeepsie. He seemed to have aged dramatically. He said he'd done very well by patenting an underwater cocktail lounge. Wish I had gotten details. I sure wonder what he did after that. Tex Windham has continued as a Dixieland bandleader. When I saw him some years ago, he expressed regret that we could not have collaborated, and I still could not convince him that there had been no possible common ground. Michael Curlin became a successful science fiction and fantasy writer. Notably, he has written a series of novels with Moriarty, Holmes' archenemy, as the protagonist. Charlie Harris, now retired, has had an eminent career as a perception psychologist and Bell Labs gadabout. His wife is the controversial Judith Rich Harris, whose claims about child rearing, notably in her book The Nurture Assumption, have been considered outrageous in some quarters. One of the spies was played by Maurice Eldridge. He was for a time my wonderful brother-in-law. He is now a vice president of Swarthmore College. Playing another of the spies in Anything and Everything was a gruff young man I thought was a friend. I shared an unfortunate project with him in the late 60s at Brown University, supposedly, quote, to try out my hypertext design, unquote, but turning into a rather nasty running fight. I greatly regret participating. I was continually insulted, lost a lot of money and time, and compromised my design principles, creating an awful structure which I believe eventually became the World Wide Web. See my apology in New Scientist, 2006, readable at xanadu.com/capital-x-capital-u-archive-space/capital-A-apology-capital-I-in-capital-N-new-capital-S-scientist-hyphen-capital-L-G.png. And what of David Baltimore? He He got the Nobel Prize for discovering reverse transcriptase. When I spoke at Caltech a few years ago, he was president of the university, and we had a nice chat over single malt whiskey. He had no recollection of the show, whatever. Oh well, people are entitled to their own interests. In my own life, the show was enormously important for my sense of identity. It was the biggest project I ever did, and all in 2 months. I allowed myself no dates and no alcohol, and I kept moving on little sleep with nothing stronger than caffeine, managing to keep up my college seminars as well. Never since have I been so efficient in the memory of that achievement, just getting such a huge show written and produced, regardless of quality, has been a driving force in my own self-confidence ever since. After that, I believed I could do anything. This has led to precarious endeavors in succeeding years, for which I'm glad I had the nerve. Because of the show, I thought of myself as a media innovator and uncanny predictor, reliably ahead of my time. This attitude became the springboard for my other predictions and initiatives. That's partly why I had the nerve in 1960 to predict personal computing and worldwide hypertext and to strive to move them forward. But that is another story. This isn't anything I'm reading, but it's told in my autobiography, Possiplex. That's P-O-S-S-I-P-L-E-X, available from lulu.com, L-U.com. End of interpolation. What remains of the show? Significant rock and roll memorabilia generally sell for vast amounts of money. Hey guys, over here, one of these days I'll auction off the last record. Meanwhile, I still have lots of posters, we'll maybe sell them on the net when there's a chance.